Okay, so we have the chance for questions from the audience. Carl has the microphone wherever he is.
Just get a clarification. When you say 87% in Arizona,
Check.
that's like, that includes Indian reservations, doesn't it? Because that's high for public, federally owned public land.
Not in Arizona.
Yes, it is.
There's a question right here, the lady.
It came from a colleague, so I'd have to.
Yeah, you better check that because I think you're off, way over.
It seems to me that a false dichotomy is.
Is there a certain speaker?
No.
No, okay.
Sort of to everybody.
Go ahead.
A false dichotomy has been set up here, and that there's the truth lies somewhere in between, and that government has to obviously get quicker and smarter and more flexible, but privatization is, of conservation areas is not necessarily the case. And I used to work for an organization called the Nature Conservancy, which is the epitome of privatization. And what's happened with along these lines is that. You know, the whole idea of conservation has evolved.
Question.
Well, the question is, you know, is this really a false economy? I mean, are you guys addressing the wrong issue? Are we missing a big point here? One of the things that you raised was about there are more scimitars in Texas than there are in Africa. You know, those aren't real scimitars. Those are kind of genetic mutants at this point, too. So I think we have to consider the quality of the kind of wildlife that you are talking about. Are we ranching wildlife? Is that what this is all about? Is this wildlife agriculture? You know, that's kind of a mixed bag of points.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit like a false dichotomy to me, too. I mean, when does... If we have a million acres in Africa, the wildlife is, or the animals that some of us would call wildlife, are free to roam about and procreate on, but there's still a fence around that million acres. I don't know. Is that, are those genetically inferior to?
There has been evidence that in some of the populations of wildlife in Africa that there's behavioral abnormalities that are showing up because these are enclosed populations, et cetera, et cetera. But really, the question is, isn't our idea of conservation evolving along with the way we're doing it?
Yeah, I think everybody has a different idea of it, which is partly why I think we should allow people to try as many different ways of doing it as we can. But I don't know how else really to answer that.
I think the Nature Conservancy is an interesting thing to bring up, only in part because that's what the book that I just finished is on the private conservation trust. It's kind of an interesting topic. And I think one of the things that is fairly clearly observable is that there are very real consequences for what gets preserved in terms of urban versus rural, whose heritage, and so on and so forth, in terms of their spatial, the parcels preserved spatial. So, for example, it's much easier with a nature conservancy or land trust. Well, TPL is a little different. Of the land trusts, it seems to me that TPL is the one that has any kind of a record at all doing any kind of urban conservation. If you look at the sort of the bed run of the private land trust, you get scattered parcels. You get a real high tendency of people to preserve land while reserving the right to build four houses for their four children. So there are a lot of problems with the Nature Conservancy model if what you're trying to do is do something more than stop housing developments. And the Nature Conservancy model is not very good at that at all. In fact, a lot of the way they raise their money is by, I mean, a lot of people would call the Nature Conservancy a high-end real estate broker.
The gentleman right there.
Yeah, I think it's for the environmental defense fellow. But anybody can answer this. I wanted to hear more about taxing pollution. I've been very interested in tax reform. I'd love nothing better than to get rid of the income tax, sales tax, property tax, you name it. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to tax, if there really is a way to tax, say, pollutive effluent,
Well, historically, and Peter makes this point in his book, I think, well, historically, environmentalists, and that's a difficult, it's used in the on the cover of his book, but it's a kind of a shaky word, but I'll use it anyway, took the view that any kind of recognition of pollution, be it in taxing it or in allowing it to be, or in giving it a permit and then trading it, was a bad thing. And so pollution taxes started out, I think, at least in my experience, as being bad even from environmentalist point of view. But I, as he points out, I think that's changed. And there is a recognition that if you tax something, the person or entity or firm emitting that product will tend to use less of it or emit less of it. So that's the resource conservation or pollution reduction point of green taxes. And it raises money, but it won't raise enough money to eliminate the income tax.
Right, gentlemen.
Mr. Huber, if I understand your distinction between hard green and soft green, hard green means that the environmentalist is interested in the environment for its own sake, but the soft green is that the environmentalist is interested in the environment for the way it allows them to manipulate the political culture, that we can control the growth of industries or the motion of populations. And I cannot contrast that with your remarks about Disneyland taking over Yosemite and Yellowstone.
You have a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Are you willing, you agree that Disney could do a better job of it. How many grizzlies are you willing to kill for this sort of feeling of national greatness that you associate with our collective ownership of things like Yellowstone?
Quite a few. because I recognize a real value in these things. I mean, if you don't believe that there's any value in that, it's easy. Then every loss of a grizzly is a net loss. But I mean, if you believe there's any value there at all, then you are going to begin making those trade-offs. And I do. I say this with utter confidence because I know my views are shared by, as I say, about 99% of my fellow citizens. So the rest of you, too bad.
you really believe that any statistical?
On national purpose and national pride, I know absolutely for sure there is only one measure of value, and that's what most of us consider valuable. I mean, how else do you assess national values other than by asking most people what they value?
I'm sort of shocked. My ox has been suddenly gored. I've been a donor and a member of the Nature Conservancy for more than 20 years, and Dr. Fairfax's remarks imply that everybody knows that they're corrupt or they're just a high-class real estate broker, and I don't know what you mean by that. Are they or are they not preserving important tracts of land for wildlife, for birds, et cetera, et cetera?
Certainly, and I should say that, you know, I, well, my own life cycle on this fascinates at least me. I started out, you know, when I first started, you know, being interested in these issues of land and land conservation, the smartest thing I could think of to do was to and having no money, but having the anticipation of some since my parents were aging, I thought I would write a will that included the Nature Conservancy as the primary beneficiary, and I have since rethought that. And I don't want to say that, I mean, I'm not going to say, and I would give up a single shard of the land that the Nature Conservancy has protected. However, I do think it's worth noting, and there was a wonderful book. It was called, perhaps you know, Digging Dirt on the. I believe it was one of the early TNC. I can look it up if you're interested. Email me and I'll get you the name of the book. But it's sort of how these deals get constructed, the Nature Conservancy acquisitions, and perhaps if you've done them, you know more about this than I do, and it might be worth hearing that again. But a lot of times, what happens is that a parcel is acquired that and instead of being like conserved, houses are constructed. There's a very famous case in Elkhorn Slough. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. Alston Chase had a field day with it. in which the area was ostensibly to be preserved, but the way the deal was funded was that, I can't remember whether it was 11 or 15. Are any of you familiar with the story? This was some years ago, but anyway. So what they did was they made a very high-class real estate development, and they put a number of private homes around the edge, and the internal area was preserved, you know, as a view shed for these high-end, you know, homes. And surely, am I doing you a disservice? Would you want to?
I feel compelled to speak out a little bit on behalf of TFC. I no longer work for them, but their idea of conservation has evolved from sort of small preserves, single species,
right.
Yes, maybe high-end, but really looking at landscape ecological issues. And I myself worked internationally for them,
uh-huh.
And we were kind of on cutting edge issues that were integrating conservation and development for indigenous people. So it's gone way beyond that.
Well, anyway, a lot of the, I mean, that would be where the argument would come from. And I can give you a couple of good books. There's another wonderful piece, which I could also give you, which has to do with what they call the gravestone theory, which is, you know, after somebody has wrecked 99% of it, they donate the last percent and they look like heroes and blah, blah, blah. So,
I mean, it just a quick note on that. I'm sure that Nature Conservancy does many, many deals, and I'm sure a few of them are problematic in one way or another. But I would ask, even in the Elkhorn Slope case, which I don't know, it's in what was the alternative? And if the alternative was development across the whole property and you're saving the slough, and in exchange you're giving up some houses and some high-end development, that may have been, probably was, in my guess, a good deal. And, you know, you, when you're working in these sectors, you're going to take some hits.
One more question. We're putting this on the website.
Okay. I think the larger issue, I mean, I think the points you brought up about private, you know, people regulating their own land and stuff, they're going to be more responsible than the government. Because, one, they're on the land. They see it firsthand. If you're directing it from 1,000 miles away from the state capital, you're not going to see the day-to-day results. But I think the larger issue about all these problems are pollution, deforestation, et cetera, are all due to overpopulation. I mean, we are the problem. And so now I'm just wondering, how would you go about handling that? Is that a thing that the government should handle? Or is that going to be left to the individual to decide and not realize that my four kids, if you times that by 500 million people, is going to make a big impact on the earth? So is that where the government has the right to step in? Or is this going to be left up to our own morality?
Well, it's not an area that I'm an expert in, but there's a chapter in Earth Report 2000, so I highly recommend that you look at that. Otherwise, you know, offhand, no, I wouldn't support a Chinese policy of how many kids you could have. No.
Peter, do you have any comment?
Malthus said populations would grow geometrically, and here we have living proof right in this audience, father of four. But I mean, look, the fact is that the wealth is the best contraceptive out there. The richer people get, the lower their fecundity, and that's the way to do it.
We've run out of time, I'm afraid. I want to thank our two major speakers for their as you can see, they both have raised very important issues. I hope both of you, I hope that everyone will be able to examine their books carefully and look into these issues further. I also want to thank our two panelists for their very incisive comments. Tom mentioned the copy of an interview of him from Metro Investment Report. Those of you who are interested in market-based approaches to transportation and related issues, I think you might find this of interest. And one other thing I might mention, in your packet there's a catalog, and one of the books in there, for those of you interested in tax policy and taxing different kinds of choices, there's a book in there called Taxing Choice, which I think you'll find quite interesting. The other thing I was going to say was that one of the areas that we, the Institute, are involved in, this is a long-term project, is a long-term series of books on different aspects of environmental policy. The first one we did was actually at another institute years ago called Water Rights. So that's how I first got to know Tom Graff. It was a book on water problems, groundwater, surface water, and so forth. And I remember when we were first organizing this project, I was told that we were totally out of our minds to consider applying economics to water issues, and that no one cared about it, no one would pay attention to it. But as soon as the book was released, it was of enormous interest. And there's a whole story behind it, which is kind of interesting politically, but ideas do have consequences, and the work of our two speakers today is a good indication of that. So thank you for joining with us, and we hope you'll be with us at a future Institute program. Good night.